You're listening to Mentoring Developers, Episode 20.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hi there, dear listeners. Do you ever wonder what it takes to be a successful software developer? Meet Glenn Block. Glenn has risen to prominence from ordinary beginnings. He went from dabbling in technology during his childhood years to working in a small organization. From there, he made his way to Microsoft, where he was instrumental in bringing modern HTTP services to developers of the .NET ilk. Now he works for Splunk, where he is a leader with a vision, and that vision includes mentorship. Mentorship is more than just an assignment or a role in the world of technology. It helps the mentor just as much as it helps the mentee in a lot of surprising ways. Helping others or knowing when to reach out yourself can build your career, build your network, and it can build your confidence in a very big way. Let's see what Glenn has to say about starting out and getting ahead in the world of software development. Here's Glenn Block. How are you, Glenn?
I'm good. How are you, Arsalan?
I'm doing fantastic, and it's so good to have you because you are somebody that a lot of people look up to. You have a ton of experience. How do you describe yourself?
Just as an individual, or you mean particularly with relation to kind of technology, software, whatever?
I deliberately kept it vague. Okay. How do you see yourself?
I think I'm a person who loves to learn. I really like learning new things. That's a big part of who I am. I also really like helping people. That's one of the things I think that I've been fortunate to be in places where I've been able to help people, either from a work perspective in terms of helping guide others or community, putting together events or just connecting with other developers. I love connecting with people. I'm like prior to coming to Microsoft, I didn't know this about myself, but I really enjoy networking, just meeting people, hearing what they do. And fortunately, I've been able to work in places where my work has brought me to different parts of the world as well. So I haven't just been limited to my local area. So I love exploring the world, going different places, meeting different people, learning new things. I'm also a parent. I'm married and I have a daughter who is now 11 years old. That's also been a pretty amazing learning experience, just watching my daughter grow up and, you know, helping guide her along the path as well, a different path. She's not at all into being a technologist, so I'm not guiding her along that path.
That's a bummer.
I love reading, big into reading. I'm big into cafes, so if you come to Seattle, you might find me hanging out in a cafe drinking my latte. I'm a big latte espresso person.
How do you like Seattle?
There's parts about it I really like. You know, the rain could definitely get to you, though lately, thanks to what looks like global warming, we haven't been getting as much of it. Seattle's a cool city. It's beautiful if you're into the outdoors. There's lots of great places to go, not that far away, like big folks, really big into rock climbing, skiing, snowboarding, very big outdoors community here.
That's great. I'm glad that you're able to live in a city like that. Some of us have to live in the Midwest, but we make the most of it.
Well, I grew up in New York, which was very flat. So in my 20s, I moved west. And one of the motivators was I didn't want to be where it was flat anymore.
So you have a lot of experience, but currently you're working at Microsoft. What are you doing there?
I don't work at Microsoft anymore. I work at Splunk.
My information is outdated. You work at
Splunk. If we can just edit.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah, okay. So currently you work at Splunk. What are you doing there?
So I kind of drive, I drive our developer platform. Splunk is a data analytics product, and it has quite a bit of ways that you can integrate with it as a developer. One that's become increasingly interesting over the last year has been systems that want to push their data directly to Splunk. And so I spent a lot of energy actually in the last year helping us to build out new capabilities in Splunk that offer a really easy way to push data from third-party systems or even from like IoT, from devices into Splunk. But overall, a lot of my focus is around developer interactions with the product.
Okay. So you're working with APIs and you're focused on REST services for the last few years. Is that a true statement?
Well, not so much in my work. Like in my work environment, I have built some APIs. A lot of the API work I've done at Splunk has actually been our SDKs that developers will use to talk to our APIs. So I drive about 8 different SDKs for different languages that make it easy for developers that want to integrate with our REST API to do it in an idiomatic way, according to whatever language that they're using. And the last year, I've certainly had a good amount of focus on building out a new API. So that data collection technique that I was describing that allows you to push data is essentially an API, a web API that can receive data in high volumes. So, but my overall scope is a lot bigger than just APIs. I work on core enhancements to the product to enable better integration scenarios, but APIs are definitely there.
Cool. So we were talking earlier and you said that you started coding very early. So yeah. Do you remember your first encounter with programming? Why did you pick it up?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I actually remember this very crisply. I think I had a friend who who had a computer. His dad was like a computer programmer, which in those days I thought was like a big thing. And his dad had actually created the New York City cab meter software, which became a big thing. But at the age of 7, for some reason, I used to go to the library a lot. I read a lot of books in the library. And I remember finding this book, which was a computer literacy book for kids. And it talked about the basics of like what computers were. It described binary and some very basic programming. And that little book, which was probably about 50 pages, it had a lot of pictures in it, just hooked me, literally. And then that was my beginning of kind of getting into computers. And then in school, I think we had a PET, Commodore PET. And then I went to this computer, this is really geeky, but my mom saw that I was getting into computers. So she sent me to like a computer code camp, or if I've ever said that before. And they had a PET. And there I worked for the summer programming on a PET, which was an early Commodore computer with a green screen, but it was a personal computer. And I learned the basics of BASIC. That was the beginning. And then I just kept going from there.
And you kept going. You never got tired of it.
No. And tired is a good thing to mention, because before you knew it, I mean, by the time I was 12, so I had my own computer, I think at 10 or 11, my mom got me a VIC 20. I remember that pretty clearly too. My uncle had a VIC 20 and he wanted to get rid of it. So that was a 4.77 megahertz machine with 4K of RAM and an 8K expansion card, and had a tape drive, and I had to use a black and white television as my monitor. So that's going back a ways. But it was better than like Hollerith card. We'd come further than that. It wasn't just punch cards. We actually had screen and keyboard and all of that. But the reason why I mentioned tired is because I used to be programming at 2 o'clock in the morning when I was like 11. My mom didn't know it. I had my computer in my room with my black and white TV, and I would just be up coding like crazy. So it is fair to say that I did not get bored, and it just kept growing. The interest just kept growing. Kind of like a virus, but a good one.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. So you started coding, and by the time you, I'm assuming you graduated high school at that time, you would have, you know, several years of experience. You'd feel pretty good about coding. Did you?
Yeah, so by the time I got to high school, so this is like way before the internet, but what had taken off were bulletin board systems. So in the old days, there was ARPANET, but I didn't know about it. But it was very common that you would have, your computer would have a modem, a modulator, demodulator, which is a box that you could use to then call up other computers. And so by the time I was 12 or 13, I got exposed to the whole world of bulletin boards and things. And then by the time I was 14 or 15, I started running my own bulletin board. So that was a big thing. So I had this board that I ran. People would upload software. Some of it was free. Some of it was not free. But it was just a lot of fun. Like, I had this whole community then. But it was like a community of introverted geeks, but it was a community nevertheless.
Yeah, I think that for a lot of us, that was one of the most important experiences of sharing stuff. And that led us to the internet. And now, when you were trying to figure out what to do with your life, did you think about going to college and studying probably computer science or engineering or something like that?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely went to school for computer science. Yes. So I definitely went to school for computer science. I ended up shifting a little bit later towards more of a business shift. So there was business computer information systems, which was kind of the blend between software development and the business side of it. But yes, I definitely went to school, and I was definitely in every kind of computer program that was available in like elementary school, high school, whatever. I was probably not doing as much non-computer work as I should have, but I was definitely obsessed and had very good grades in all the computer classes.
That's great. I mean, to have that obsession, it was definitely takes you far, but I want to know if you think it was worth it now that you have so much experience. What if you didn't go to college? What if you didn't get a computer science degree?
I think college offered a level of refinement, so I think it was advantageous. I didn't go as far as some people go, but I definitely found value in it. I mean, there were things I got exposed to, like around systems analysis. Some of it I haven't used. Some of it I have. Even things like building flowcharts and data flow diagrams. I mean, there are times when that's been useful. I don't think that college can teach you passion for programming, though. I'm a pretty big believer in that. I think there are things I picked. I mean, that's something that an individual either, I think, can grow within themselves. So I think college made me a little bit more structured and refined in what I did. Although that's probably an irony. Like, a lot of people that know me know I'm not a super... I've become more refined the last couple of years, actually. But I think there was a period when I was anything but refined. But it did provide some structure.
Some people say that the value of college is not in the technical knowledge that you gain, but in the other knowledge that you gain around the humanities and the way to communicate with people, to write.
I think that I certainly found benefit there. College in general, like communication. For example, I didn't realize I was going to end up doing a huge amount of public speaking. But in college, I took a course on business, on presenting, business communication. And it involved us doing quite a bit of presenting, and it was something I was comfortable with. But it certainly helped grow that. And I think the structured level of things, like having to work with teams to get stuff done, and, you know, this notion of kind of requirements that you have to deliver on, I think those are things that college certainly helped. It also can help in just building connections. College is where I got exposed to Linux. I hadn't gotten exposed. Now, it could be also that had I been in high school at that time, like I I had a friend who was really into Slackware Linux, and he was in one of my computer classes, and that got me exposed to want to play with it. And you know, back then it was really painful to work with Linux. You had to like build your own kernel and such. And I'm not the Linux expert even to this day, though I'm probably stronger now than I was then. But that's an example of an organic thing that I picked up that I, you know, probably would not have gotten exposure to in the circles that I ran in had I not gone through school. So I think there are things that are kind of maybe hard to measure, but valuable. Organic things.
Mm-hmm. And after college, no, let me ask you this. During college, did you work in software? Did somebody pay you to write software?
You know, I worked in the computer lab. I ran the computer lab in college. So I wasn't getting paid to write software. I did little things on the side. As a matter of fact, the first time I ever got paid to build anything, I got paid, I think it was $180. This is when I was in junior high even. And I was, I had a TRS-80 color computer. And I built this architectural software thing for a guy who paid me $180. And I thought, wow, like I am rich. This is like amazing. And I was really young. I was surprised. You know, he probably got his money's worth. But for me, it was like, wow, you actually want me to build that? In college, I don't, you know, the only paid I got was to run the computer lab. So I was that guy who, you know, you bring back then, you bring your document in and you want to get it printed. So I tell you, okay, go log on that machine, or I log on the machine for you and I read your file and I print it. It wasn't a super exciting existence, but it did give me a chance to write a lot of code while I was there, because I was half bored to death, you know, while I wasn't helping people print their documents.
So when did you get your first job, and how did you get your first job as a programmer?
Interesting. Let me think. So I did a lot of dabbling. So I used to actually go to Radio Shack, believe it or not, and I would play around with their computers. This is like getting really geeky. This is what I used to do in junior high. I would go hang out there, believe it or not, like after school, and I'd play with computers and things like that, because they always had better computers than I had at home, and I couldn't afford like the bigger ones yet. Ultimately, I was able to. So my first paid programming job was out of high school. I did a little bit of programming and a little bit of networking for this small consulting company. And then my first real job actually was when I came out of school in my 20s. I went and worked for this company that did direct mail. They were a very large company in New York that had a big kind of direct mail business that addressed new homeowners. That was their specialty, and they had a lot of C programs. And so I joined there initially not doing programming. I was just doing like database administration, DBase. It's not really database, but operations. And while I was in the operations department, I started programming. I started programming DBase. And it became apparent to my bosses that, hey, I really can write code. And I hadn't done C, though. That's why I came in doing the DBase stuff. I knew some DBase from school. But then I evolved into becoming a full-fledged C programmer. I had done some C, but not a lot. So I learned it kind of on the job while I was doing the DBase programming stuff, and then that DBase 3, and then that led to becoming a C programmer. So that was my first real, I would say, I've landed programming job, C programmer.
So when you were working in your first job, did you find it easy to become accepted as a valuable contributing member of the organization or the developer community in general? Did you struggle with anything?
I had no community presence, period. So community for me were the developers that I worked with in my company. I mean, it was a different world then, to be honest. Like, I think it wasn't as much of a, like, everything has changed now. Social is so much a part of what we do now as developers, or at least there's a very big social aspect if you want to tap into it, which I've certainly tapped into the last number of years. Back then, you know, I was just getting stuff done. I think the thing that worked well for me is I was always very aggressive going after stuff. And I would always try to do above the bare minimum. Like, I never tried to just get the job done. I was always thinking about, how can I do this more efficiently? How can I do this better? How can I improve? So I think that worked out well. It's a mix, because sometimes people are threatened by that. I remember when I worked in the DBase operations side, there was a guy who was seemed very threatened, because before I came to the department, he was kind of the programming guru, so to speak. But he really wasn't that great of a programmer, but he had more programming knowledge than a lot of the other operators. So I think when I came, there was a little bit of an intimidation there. And I was trying to teach other people in the department how they could do this stuff too, how it wasn't like rocket science. So, but once I got into programming overall, I think the environment I was in was very supportive. I outgrew it pretty quickly, but they were definitely supportive.
So how did you keep growing your skill set? Did you even try that? Were you thinking, well, I'm doing DBase right now, but you know, the next hot thing is that other thing over there, maybe C++, and let me go and...
Well, yeah. So I started doing C, as I mentioned. The hot thing actually became Visual Basic. So I had a guy that I worked with who was like a genius. He was a C programmer, C++. It was C and C++, by the way. It wasn't just C. And he was like a genius. And he was learning how to build Windows apps. That was his thing. He wanted to build like real Windows apps. And in those days, building a Windows app was a thing. I mean, it was like a million lines of code to build. Now, a lot of that code would be generated with tools, but it was massive, the code that would get generated to build a Windows app. And I remember how excited he was. His name was David. I forgot his last name. He was older than I was, and that was his big thing. And lo and behold, he got hired to do real Windows development. Back then, it was really like a black art if you knew how to do it. For me, I saw a quicker route. I happened to see, I think I was in the store somewhere, and I saw a Visual Basic starter kit, which was like for Visual Basic 4. And actually, no, at my job, they had some VB3 development. They had done a lot of Access development, and they had some VB3 development. And I looked at VB3. I wasn't super impressed, but I looked at VB4. From VB3 to VB4, there were big jumps in terms of the overall experience of building apps. And I looked at that and I was like, wow, I could build kind of the equivalent to what David has to do in a million lines in like very few lines using a drag and drop kind of editor using Visual Basic. And I fell in love with Visual Basic right there. And then I had the opportunity to sell it within my team because we would build these ANSI screen C apps that would be used for data analysis. Kind of the early days of big data. It wasn't very big. I think we were a 5 gigabyte database, which was huge, really huge at the time. I want to say 5 gigabyte, not 5 megabyte. I think it was 5 gigabyte. And that was massive. We had our own proprietary data store we built on top of B-Treve. And anyway, we built these UIs that were all these ANSI, you know, DOS-based, DOS console-based UIs. And I had to rebuild this research application that we had. And I was like, why don't we use Visual Basic? Like, we can build it with a nice GUI. It's modern, whatever. And we were Windows for workgroups, by the way, just to give you an idea of what version of Windows we were running at the time. And I got the buy-in to try it out. And I built a prototype and showed how this could work. And then I was able to build that app. And that led me on a path where I would be writing Visual Basic code for quite a while. Ultimately, I realized that the place that I was not where I wanted to be, because VB became a thing that I was really excited about. And I wanted to be at a place where that was important And it was kind of like interesting where I was, but it wasn't going to be a lot of VB development going forward. And plus, the work they were doing was not honestly that exciting to me. So I went through a recruiter and I got a job actually making double what I was making, which was pretty nice. And working in a shop that was doing a lot of access development, but that really wanted to migrate to VB and was looking at doing more and more VB development. And this was, again, around the VB4, VB5 timeframe. So I basically got that job. And that set me off on a much more interesting trajectory.
Do you think that one strategy that new developers can have or can follow is to follow the leader in technology, what's hot and what's good, and try to be on top of it, try to be on the cutting edge? That's, you know, that's a moving target, versus the other approach they can have is, let's be really good at this one thing, for example, Java, and let's have really, really deep knowledge, and that way you can differentiate yourself.
I mean, I think it really depends on the individual. I think one challenge today is technology is moving so fast, and if you want to stay relevant, you know, there's challenges there. And the number of technologies that I've been learning just in the last year alone, recently I've been getting pretty heavily into the whole DevOps world, and also looking at things like containerization, and it's an explosion of technology and terms that you start using there. One challenge, I think, is, you know, something that's hot today might not be tomorrow. And that's a bit of an art, and I've gotten better at it over the years, of being able to gauge. Like, I usually don't jump on something right away as soon as it comes out. I'll wait a bit. But there are signs that things are really taking hold. And when I see those signs that that's really taking hold, well, then I also have to decide, is this relevant? Is this relevant to my world? Is this going to be relevant to my world? And so one, for example, in my current world that I started to get a lot into is the whole containerization thing and the realization watching it that this is actually going to very much impact the world that I'm in. So better to kind of learn it now. I think it really depends on the individual. I think it's, I mean, you can certainly stay with a technology and just get deep. The challenge there is, how do you prevent yourself from getting stale? That's that happens. That's an interesting challenge. Does it matter to you? It may, if you want to be able to have more options. That's what I look at. I look at that, not, you know, I try to keep myself from staying stale, which, one, keeps it interesting, two, gives me more options if I decide I want to do something different. Or sometimes it gives me more options just based on a changing landscape. You know, like maybe the area where I'm in, and this is part of where having the foresight, although this may not be important to us now, maybe in a year it will be. Well, me having that foresight to figure out that this is something worth knowing about or diving a bit into gives me an edge if it turns out that that's the direction where we actually go. But there's no crystal ball.
There is no crystal ball. You have to follow your instinct. But I'm wondering about what you have seen over the years as somebody who started out and then who grew in, you know, your career grew and you became more and more senior now. You were in management, and I'm assuming that you have a lot of say in who gets hired in Splunk and in other places where you work. You must have seen new people come in, and you must have observed how they do. Can you talk about some of their struggles or some of the issues that new developers or, you know, new hires go through? And if you have any personal experience of that, and what's your advice for them?
So, I mean, I think one thing from a corporation perspective or organization perspective is I'm really, this was the reason I was also interested in this podcast. I'm a big fan of mentoring culture. The idea that, hey, somebody comes in and there's somebody there to kind of help them along, just guide them. So I think that's a place where certainly organizations can help. And it's a place where my current organization, we could do a lot better, to be honest. Microsoft had a very good mentoring culture. I hold that up often as being like the gold standard, where it really was recognized that, you know, mentoring is a valuable thing for employees to do, both on the mentoring side and on the mentee side. So I think that's one thing. I think as far as individuals, it's a tough one. I think at Splunk, you know, we look for people that are really motivated. I mean, it depends on your level too, obviously. Like if somebody's coming in at like a senior or principal level, the expectation is going to be different. But I think for us, it becomes pretty important that we, passion and drive, I think is something that I can consistently say has been important wherever I've gone. Where I would say that there were organizations early on where maybe passion and drive was less critical, where, you know, people maybe just do the job and they're just getting the job done and going home. I know for me, I look for people that are really driven, that love what they're doing, that, you know, look at programming almost as kind of like an art, like designing software can be a beautiful thing. Done right and caring about it, really caring about it, I think is something that we look for. Like right now we're in the midst of hiring some people, and I think we certainly look for that passion and that drive. I think another aspect is being able to work with teams. If you're younger, that can take more time, and it's understood that, you know, hey, we need to work with this person, and we'll think, does this person have the right attitude that they're going to be able to interact? Excuse me. And work well in our culture. And of course, if that person is more senior, we're going to have a higher expectation that person's going to be able to just kind of fit in. Not everybody likes to be in a team culture. So for us, a lot of what we do is team-based. So
have you noticed that new hires or newer developers who have, let's say, less than 2 years of experience, they struggle more in the technical tasks? Or do you think they have, you know, different struggles perhaps fitting in other types of problems?
I think a lot of places where engineers struggle when they get started is communication, knowing when they're blocked and being able to communicate that. That's a place where I've seen a common pitfall. Like, you know, either they're worried because they don't want to send a message like, I can't do it. And then sometimes they get trapped. And as managers have to be conscious of that, you know, somebody might get trapped in a place where, you know, they're blocked and they really need help, but they're not necessarily able to communicate that. Or they think, well, I'll find my way through it. But the amount of time that you could spend. So I guess one advice I would give for somebody that's junior is don't be afraid to reach out. Often, I would rather know that you're blocked than have you, you know, and there's a balance, because sometimes you want somebody to struggle a bit because it's healthy for them to work through a problem and figure it out. But there's a real balance there. You know, there's, okay, I kind of can't figure it out, I need some pointers and I kind of get through it, versus I just cannot make progress. And then it can become almost demeaning to that individual that they're stuck and they don't want to communicate it. So my advice as somebody who's been in the industry quite a while would be, I actually value much more if you communicate to me. If you communicate to me that you're blocked, then I can help you. And I think that's a hard thing, especially when somebody's really junior, because they really want to establish themselves, like they know what they're doing. But realize that, like, when we bring in people that are really junior, we don't expect you to know exactly what you're doing. Otherwise, when we get somebody who's a senior person, sure, we expect they know what they're doing. What we look for is the right attitude and the ability to be able to work through things. With guidance, even, you know, like if you come to me and say, well, I'm blocked, I have no idea what to do. then I would look for somebody that if I come back to them and say, okay, well, okay, I've analyzed the problem. You can do this and you can do that. That they're going to be okay with taking that guidance and running with it. But yeah, that would be a big advice to me for people that are even senior. Certainly you can communicate, but I would say that the burden when you're more senior, there's going to be a higher level of expectation of what you can do. And you should focus and be thinking a lot about making sure that you fill those gaps if you care about, you know, kind of further advancement within the organization or growing. There's an expectation of things. And the more senior you are, the higher the level of expectation of what you can do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So keep trying. So the advice, I think the summary of that is, try your best. Try to find a solution if you're stuck in a problem. But when you come to a standstill, then reach out.
Right. And use your peers as well. This becomes more relevant, I think, as you get more senior. You know, like it's okay. Like solving, the most important thing is really to help solve problems. It's not that you have to be the person always with the answer. Use the people around you in a positive way. And this is where, for me, I found kind of the networking thing has helped. But there was a period when I had quite the ego and I didn't want to look around. I wanted to figure out the problem. And I suffered because of that. There were periods in my career early on where I suffered because I was stubborn and I felt like I had the way. And then I learned later on that, hey, you know, the important thing is finding a solution, not your solution, a solution, the best solution. The best solution doesn't have to be your solution. So that would be a very big thing that I would, you know, say will save a lot of people a lot of pain, engineers, if they realize that, you know, the best solution is the best solution. It doesn't have to be the one that you came up with. And don't be afraid to, you know, work with, you know, to use the people around you to try to help figure out what that best solution is and be open to ideas other than the one that you're most passionate about. I think that's been a place where it has really, you know, there are times when I used to go into conversations or design meetings where I was just really passionate about the right way. And that was it. Like I was just not give or take, you know, on any other idea. And I think especially the last 5 or 8 years, I've become a lot more open to saying, okay, well, what's the right way to solve this problem? Sure, I have the thing I'm passionate about and I want to get my ideas into the mix, but let's keep our eyes on the prize. What is the bigger problem that we're trying to solve? What is the best solution to get there, regardless of who came up with the idea?
Yeah, I think the idea that you have to prove a point or you have to prove that you are better than others, and this can be pretty toxic and create a pretty toxic atmosphere where people are trying to take credit for things and then the blame, they're trying to diffuse the blame or to direct the blame towards somebody else.
Well, there's that, but it's not always that though. I mean, there is that. That's a big problem, totally. People taking credit for things they didn't do, people blaming, pushing blame. But I think the other thing that I was talking about is sometimes just a natural inclination that you care about the thing that you care about and you want it to be the winning idea.
Yep. And that's all true. And I think that we have to really watch out for that. Now, what I want to know is from the other side of the equation, from the point of view of the managers, the hiring people, the people who are the people who run the organization, what are they doing? Do you think that in general, we have organizations that nurture and enable new developers to come in and shine and thrive? Do you think that's what the industry is doing in general?
I think it's hard to put a blanket statement. I won't say that I know enough about the industry across the board to say that. I think I've seen some good examples. I've seen some bad examples. So I think it's a mixed bag.
Okay. So let's say that I have a startup company and I want to hire a bunch of new developers. And I'm not sure how to go about it and how to onboard them, how to hire them, and so on. Can you give me advice as the hiring manager?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that startups have brought, which has trickled into a lot of the enterprises or bigger organizations as they've tried to emulate startups, is the whole cultural aspect. You know, just building a fun culture is something that I think a lot of big companies have taken a cue from the startup world. You know, things like perks, like food and, you know, games and little things that don't usually cost a huge amount, but that actually go a long way. Like I know in my current company, like Splunk, for example, we've got great, really good food perks. Some companies have better ones like Google, and there are some startups that do, but we've got a really good situation there. So I think creating a fun culture is one nice thing that a startup has a lot of ability to do. I mean, it depends on how well funded they are, of course. There are limits. But and I think as a startup, having really good transparency, you know, especially like if you're asking, because when you're a startup, you're asking people to come on board with something that, though there's a pretty potentially high level of risk, and they're coming on board to be part of that. So making them feel like there's real transparency as to what the business is doing, its goals, what's the outlook. I think those are really important things in a startup. I think promoting a lot of innovation is an important thing in a startup, like making people really feel like this is theirs, ownership. A lot of that, I think, becomes more important in a startup. It's important in a larger company as well, but becomes a lot more important in a startup. I would say great culture, offering developers interesting technologies they can work on. That's always a plus. You know, people, I think it's very common that startups want to attract by saying, hey, we're working on blah. You know, we're working with Docker, we're working with Golang, working with this, working with that. So I think that is really important. That's also important from a VC perspective as well, because when VCs are investing, they often do look at the technology stack that you're using, and is that stack a hot stack or not, becomes more important when you're in kind of that investor-driven startup world.
As you know, in the month of January, we did a giveaway. We're giving away a screencast bundle worth quite a lot of money, JavaScript Fundamentals by WatchMeCode.net, and we had a few comments. So now it's time to announce the winner. And the winner of the bundle is Faraz Ali. Faraz, thank you for your comment, and I will be sending you the coupon code for the JavaScript Fundamentals bundle. So, now that contest is over, let me tell you about the contest in February. In February, all you have to do is, again, write a comment, send me a question. Now you have two choices. You can either send me an email, us@mentoringdevelopers.com, or the other choice is to leave a comment right on the blog post. All right, I'll throw in another choice. You can also leave a comment on iTunes. Either one of these three places, you can leave a comment or a request, and you can win 30-day coupon codes to Code School, to Pluralsight, and much, much more. So don't wait. Send me your comments. Let me know how I can help you. Do you think that it's a good idea for startups to have a regimented mentorship program where they have, you know, people come in and they go through this process and come out with, you know, with the confidence that they need to succeed? A lot of times startups don't do that because they don't have the capacity. They feel they don't have the money or the resources to train anybody. They just want very senior people, maybe two or three people. And that's kind of how they roll. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it depends. I think there are some startups that they're not going to be able to afford the people that they want unless they give them really high equity and they can get someone who's really interested in taking a gamble with that company. they may actually not be able to, you know, depending on what their, how much funding they've raised, they may not be able to really afford that person. But I don't think you need a lot to have a mentoring culture. You know, if you're a really small startup, you could say, well, you know, let's say you're the CEO. You could say, hey, you know, one of the perks, you come on with us, I'm going to offer you, you know, 30 minutes a month. Maybe that won't last forever. You're going to get a chance to get mentored from the person who's, you know, running the business and find out what's important to them. I don't think it takes a lot. I mean, there's different levels, of course, of mentoring culture, but I think you can build one without a lot of, without a huge financial investment.
You've had mentors.
I did.
Did they have an effect on you? How did they help you?
Absolutely. I'm a huge believer in mentors. And I was fortunate to have some really great ones. Well, so I used to have this policy, like when I was at Microsoft is really where I started to care a lot about mentors. I had mentors outside of Microsoft that were friends I knew in the industry, particularly in the Bay Area, that were not in my workplace, but that were able to advise me, you know, to go further if I wanted to go further. And that ultimately, I think, helped incentivize me to get to Microsoft, because I was feeling like I wanted more and I wasn't super happy in the company that I was in, though I was working on interesting technology. But at Microsoft in particular, I had some fantastic mentors, and I have a couple of good mentors now at Splunk. I think, so one policy I would have is I would try to get multiple mentors of different levels, like one who was closer to my level that could just, but maybe was doing it longer, who could just kind of advise me on the things to look for. And then one who was maybe significantly more senior that would just help broaden my perspective and help me to grow and help me to think about things on a completely different level. So that worked out pretty well for me. And I was, again, fortunate at Microsoft that I had some fantastic mentors who you know, really gave me a lot of guidance, a lot of advice. Sometimes mentors can lead to opportunity as well. You know, being selfish, like if your mentor has you on their back of their mind, so if something comes up that you could be a potential good fit for, it's, you know, a natural. So I certainly would say that some of my mentoring relationships did benefit me in terms of creating other opportunities, but the higher level value was just having somebody that I could talk to that could be raw with me, excuse me, advise me on things I should be thinking about, help me to have a better perspective on a problem that I was experiencing. And this is why, like in a big company, I would often have mentors that were not directly involved with the same world I was involved with. So that this way, it's just a way to avoid there being any kind of weirdness. Like they're not biased. You know, they're not advising me on things that have their own biases because it directly affects their world. But I found it to be tremendously valuable. And I also was a mentor for a bunch of people at Microsoft. And since while I was at Microsoft, I branched out a bit. And I have some folks from the community that I mentor as well. On the side, which is interesting. But yeah, I think it's really valuable. And as I was telling you earlier, I think it's kind of incumbent on you when you've found benefit from being mentored that you mentor others as well.
That's really interesting. I was wondering if there is somebody out there who is a new developer, perhaps they've been coding for a couple of years, perhaps they're thinking about coding, and they really don't have a network. They don't know, and they don't work at Microsoft, so there's no assigned mentor. And in your case, also, you had mentors within the company, you had mentors outside the company, and you had mentees within and outside the company. So how would a person go about getting a mentor? Because these are great, you know, mentors, yes, are busy, right?
They are busy, and it is a devotion of time. Granted, I would say in my case that there are times when I've been better than others as both a mentor and a mentee. So one thing I would say is that, you know, I talked about social, this social world that we're in now. Like, there's user groups everywhere. I think going to things like user groups is a great way to meet people and potentially to meet people that you build connections with that may be in a place where they can provide you guidance or you can provide them guidance or advice. I mean, I would argue that I have a, in one way, I have a lot of mentors because I have a lot of people that I reach out to if I have, you know, if I need to know about this or I need to know about that. I guess the difference is that a, what differentiates it is that a mentor is a more personalized commitment between two people. But I would say a user group is one great way to do that, is to just get out there, meet people through that avenue. Even social media like Twitter or discussion forums is another great way. You know, you don't have to go anywhere other than to a specific address in your, you know, in your address bar. Getting engaged with like different types of forums or discussion groups that are out there, and then you get to know some people and then you build up relationships that way is certainly an option as well.
Do you think that it's a good idea for new people to try to go out and give presentations at user groups and maybe even conferences?
It depends. I mean, it depends on what you want. I think you can. I think it's also like depending on where you are in your development, like where do you want to put your attention? I would say it's good to go regardless, just to learn what other people are doing. Certainly, I would never discourage one from speaking. I think it builds, you know, it builds good skills as far as confidence and other kinds of things. And it does certainly become a way to know people. I guess the hard thing is when you're really junior, is that you're in kind of a, like, we're always learning, but at some point you get to a place where you've learned enough to really talk about it. And I think it's good to focus on, you know, when you're in a very, when you're very much in an early learning phase, it's good to focus more on learning than speaking about the learning. That's just my biased opinion. And then you get to a place where you do both. If you want to. For myself, there were many years where I wasn't speaking about anything. You know, I've talked to my friends, but I was basically just learning, learning, learning. And then finally I got to a place where I started to talk about it. And what is that right place? Well, that's up to an individual to describe. But I would say it's when you no longer consider yourself or your peers no longer consider you kind of a junior developer. Now, I might get slammed for saying this. This is just Glenn's opinion. I know there are people that speak as junior developers, so I don't want to say like that's a bad thing. I'm just, my mental model is that you want to get to a certain point because, you know, teaching is about experience. It's hard to teach if you don't have the experience.
Yep, that makes sense. On the flip side, the other side of the argument will be that anybody who is doing anything worthwhile, perhaps there's a person that doesn't know that. And so there's a Cold Fusion developer in maybe a 6 months of Cold Fusion. I may not care about that per se as somebody who's focused on another set of technologies. And maybe I have, you know, 10, 20 years experience, but I don't know about Cold Fusion. And it may be interesting for me to learn. And certainly that person is more experienced in that real narrow thing. But of course, that also, there's the other aspect of being able to speak and having the confidence. So there's both sides to that, and I see benefits. I think
yeah, so I'll modify a bit of what I said, and again regardless of whatever I said, I'm certainly supportive. If people want to speak, they should speak. Like, it's definitely a great opportunity. And there are people that give talks about wading their way through something that they just, you know, spent a couple of days playing with, and now I'm going to share what I learned. And they're going to, like you said, they're going to be able to communicate their experience. They're going to be able to help somebody else who might want to tread in their path. So I was just giving kind of a general guideline, but I have seen individuals where I feel like they've put my perspective, like they put too much attention too early on the let me tell people and educate people about stuff before they really got the foundation. And I think that can be hurtful long term.
Do you listen to any podcasts? Is there any that you recommend our listeners to listen to?
I don't listen to a lot of podcasts these days. When I do, like I sometimes listen to .NET Rocks. I still like .NET Rocks. I sometimes listen to Hansel Minutes, so obviously I have bias there. I don't listen to either very frequently, but I do listen to both. There are some very new podcasts that I've been getting into, like because I've been getting into the whole kind of continuous integration, continuous deployment world. So there's a bunch of podcasts in that world. There's a brand new one. I'm forgetting the name of it right now. Let's see if I can remember the name of it. I don't remember the name. But yeah, I'm not a regular listener. I kind of do it in more of a organic fashion. If I feel like listening to one, I'll listen to one, but I'm certainly not religious about it. And what now, about, of course, I have one.
You do have a podcast.
Well, it's not really a podcast yet, to be fair. It's more of a, at this point, it's more of a Google Hangout, but we are turning it into a proper podcast as well.
And you're doing it with somebody else.
Yes, with Daryl Miller, who I think you interviewed.
I recently interviewed Daryl, and
the new stack. There it is, new stack. No. The podcast, just remembered it.
Okay.
The new stack. So for anybody who's like really interested in kind of where the container world and the ecosystem around containers, like Mesos and Kubernetes and all of that, that's a new podcast that I'm getting into, the new stack.
Excellent. Well, excited to get a chance to hear that. And I think our listeners will love to hear from somebody as accomplished as you about some of the new directions where technology is heading. So yeah, send this information to me, Glenn, when you get a chance, and I'll make sure that it's in the podcast episode. That's going to be on the blog, mentoringdevelopers.com. So, but you also don't watch screen. My guess is that you don't really spend time watching screencasts or reading blogs.
I actually read quite a bit of blogs, but I do it in a very organic fashion. So I basically find out about blogs through like Twitter, or some of the people I know in Facebook will post a link to something. I don't use an RSS reader. I don't do things in a super deterministic fashion, but I absolutely do a lot of reading. And a lot of that reading that I do is based on mostly things I see in Twitter. Like I see a link, and then and when I blog now, I still blog some degree. More blogging I do on the Splunk blog than my own personal, but I still blog on my personal. I always share that link on Twitter. That's kind of like my main way of consuming and sharing information.
Do you think it's important for new developers to show the world what they can do? Maybe have a website, a blog, or maybe have open source projects just to project their skills and get a name for themselves. That's a trend, or let's say a movement these days, and that developers should promote themselves because hiring managers and other developers are looking at their GitHub profiles, their LinkedIn profiles, and you know, the body of work that they have done, instead of, because you know, most developers, you know, they work in proprietary environments and nobody really knows what they're doing.
Yeah, that's a great question. So going back to when I was talking about the mentoring, I think one of the things I missed completely is that, you know, an easy way to get to know people and to interact and to grow your network is through open source development. It's not just about hiring managers. It's that you're working with other technologists when you're working on open source projects, whether you start one or you work with other people. That's been tremendously valuable for me, by the way. I have several open source projects, some that I maintain where I'm like the main maintainer, others that I work with others or that I'm, you know, I contribute. That certainly has provided a great way to meet people, make connections, and, you know, some of those even turn into like little mentoring relationships. So I'm a big fan of that, not just for the hiring side. Yes, there are more and more companies, though I think it's still an echo chamber, that do look at your GitHub profile. And they want to get a sense, particularly if they're doing third-party libraries or open-source libraries, they want to know that, hey, you know, the person. I think it's less important if it's just what is being built internally in terms of the stress on it. But if you're building a product that has integration points or libraries that third-party developers are supposed to use, then they'll be, you know, they'll be looking at, hey, what have you done? Do you have GitHub projects? Yada, yada. I definitely think it's valuable. And like I said, even if it doesn't help you with hiring, it will help you meet people and potentially other opportunities like other jobs. And because what will happen is, you know, you might have somebody who reaches out to you who saw the work that you did on such and such projects. And they say, oh, well, would you like to come work for us?
I think this is excellent advice, and everything you have told us, I think all of our listeners will do well to write it down and try to act on it, because this is coming from somebody who's really successful. And we have taken a lot of time, Glenn. I know you're busy, so we're going to wrap up this interview, and I want to give you the chance to talk about, you know, any final words or give us any final advice for new developers or for companies that are looking to hire, or you can also talk about some of your projects, anything that you'd like people to go to and visit.
I think I'll just focus on the mentoring aspect. You know, I would advise anybody who's listening, who has any number of, you know, who considers themselves more than the most beginner, to help the beginners, you know, to, and if you're more senior, then to help others. I think there's real value. I certainly believe in everything that goes around comes around. There's real value there. And don't be afraid to look to others. Like I said earlier, it's been a real value in my career to have others guide me. And you'll find people that are willing to do it. I think you just have to be, you know, have a good heart, be going with a good intention. And that shines through. And you'll find people that are absolutely willing to help you. And, you know, don't be afraid to reach out to others. As far as the keeping on top of the latest technology, I mean, I would certainly advise that it's good to know what's there, but don't, I guess, my takeaway there would just be, there's a lot that's going on. Try to evaluate which ones are the right ones for you to invest your time in. And so for me, that's, you know, I generally try not to just jump on something right away. I may watch it. So I know I said this stuff earlier, but these are just things I'll reiterate. And, you know, I guess a big thing is just have confidence in yourself. That's easy to say, but, I think a big part of succeeding in the industry is actually about building your own confidence, knowing that you can achieve what you set out to achieve, and you'll often find that you can. You'll often find that you can do things that you wouldn't have thought on first glance were possible, but if you really put your mind to it, you can do it.
Glenn, it was a pleasure talking to you, and hopefully we'll catch you again later at, you know, for a follow-up interview.
Okay, well, thank you. It was my pleasure to be on this call.
See you, Glenn.
Bye-bye.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.